Welcome to Devon and to Dartington Hall, which is just outside Totnes, in one of the most beautiful parts of this beautiful county. We are in the Great Hall at Dartington, a magnificent medieval structure, and an apt setting for the literary weekend here, which is organised by Way With Words, who are our hosts. On our panel, Dr. David Starkey is distinguished as a historian and a teacher at the London School of Economics, but as an irrepressible controversialist, he is familiar to a wider audience for the intellectual barbs with which he pierces the prejudices of others, the better, of course, to advance his own, on Radio 4's The Moral Maze. Lady Warnock became prominent as a philosopher who then applied her academic distinction to dilemmas of public policy. The range of good and great concerns which have enjoyed the benefit of her insistent intellect include education, the environment, animal experiments, and most contentiously, the inquiry into human fertilization. When she was a child, this is by her own account, she was always seeking attention and, she said, prone to bossiness. As an adult, she's had her fair share of attention, of course, but bossy? Of course not. Jonathan Porritt was the director of Friends of the Earth. He is the writer, broadcaster, and polemicist. No other individual has campaigned more assiduously or successfully year in, year out to put the green back into Britain. He is tireless, eloquent, erudite, and humorous. For all this, of course, he deserves a knighthood, which he probably, I'm afraid, won't get, if only because he recently inherited a baronetcy and therefore properly I should refer to him as Sir Jonathan. Miles Kington must write more daily columns in a year than anyone else in British journalism. More impressively, as readers of The Independent and before that The Times will know, his stock in trade is humour, by turns wry and whimsical, mocking and mordant. From time to time, he has been tempted to use his column to hint mildly that any questions is sometimes top-heavy with politicians, and short of people, well, like the fourth member of our panel, Miles Kington. Could we please have our first question?
Anna McKenzie. Was the publication of The Leak by the Times newspaper irresponsible?
The Leak by the Times newspaper giving some details from the framework document concerning Northern Ireland. Baroness Warnock.
Well, I don't actually think The Leak has made very much difference, because what is the agenda would have become clear sooner or later anyway. And the agenda is the complete impossibility of the ceasefire coming together to be on the same platform, because the Northern Irish ceasefire really wants to ensure that connection with the United Kingdom goes on. The Southern ceasefire is based on the supposition that there will be a United Ireland. And I think this question, which is really deep incompatibility, has got to be faced sooner or later. So personally, I don't blame the Times or any other leak for bringing this right out into the open. Whether or not Northern Ireland is going to remain part of the United Kingdom is the central issue.
Jonathan Porritt?
I think it was irresponsible. Not so much because they dealt with the leak, but because of the gloss, or to use the journalist word, the spin they put on it. They allowed very selective quotes to be taken from the framework document. They then interpreted those quotes in a very selective way. They asked a journalist on the Times to do it, whose known political affiliations are clear. Mr. D'Ancona is well known for his support and sympathy for the unionists. He is a member of an organization called Friends of the Union, and he's published widely, saying very clearly what his beliefs and opinions are. And actually, they're not so very different from what Mary Warnock has just said, that it won't be possible to bring these sides together. And I must say, for a paper like The Times, perhaps one shouldn't any longer expect too much of that paper, but I really do feel that the way in which they handled that at this particular time was quite specifically geared to causing mischief. And at such a crucial and delicate moment in the deliberations going on between two governments, given that the vast majority of people in Northern Ireland, whatever the politicians may say, that the vast majority of people in Northern Ireland are now desperately hopeful that some peace will be sustained out of this process, I thought the way the Times dealt with it was deeply irresponsible.
Dr. Starkey.
Oh. Wasn't that just typical of Sir Jonathan? When we have a leak that deals with Westland, with the Belgrano, with any case that's approved of by the liberal establishment, we applaud. We say we must have more open government. But let the leak deal with a question of high policy that touches the lives, the traditions, and the history of millions of people, then immediately, oh, the public shouldn't know about it. Oh, we have delicate negotiations. And of course, ladies and gentlemen, this is not the first leak. The Times published a whole column of leaks on what Major has been doing on Ireland. I'm afraid I agree completely with Baroness Warnock. What Major has been doing on Ireland is what he's been trying to do over Europe. He's been trying to make oil and water blend into a perfect mayonnaise. But I'm afraid Major is about the worst cook we've had in British politics for a very long time, and the oil and the water will not mix. And again, Jonathan, everybody in Northern Ireland wants peace. How often have we heard that? Let us be honest. Why can't we face facts? You want us to face facts as an environmentalist about the natural world. I would invite you as a historian to try and face facts and their personal bitter facts about the nature of conflict in a country like Ireland. Stop giving us greenwash.
Miles Kington, I'll come back to you in a moment, Jonathan.
Well, yes, it was irresponsible, but then most journalism is irresponsible, and we expect that. I don't worry about that. In fact, I didn't read about this at all, because when I worked for the Times, I acquired the habit of not reading the paper I was working for, a habit which has lasted into my post-Times life. So I don't read the Times, and I didn't see this. That Northern Ireland, was it?
Thank you.
I also try and steer clear of the Northern Ireland situation, because I was born in Northern Ireland, because my father was a soldier stationed over there, and it's in my passport. And whenever I go through customs, they say, born in Northern Ireland, let's ask them a few questions, and they take me over to a corner and say, what's this about? So I've acquired a holier-than-thou attitude in Northern Ireland.
David Starkey was stern with Jonathan for suggesting that everyone, or almost everyone, wanted peace. Is your instinct that everyone in Northern Ireland does want peace, bar those who've been latterly putting the gun down?
Everyone wants peace.
On their terms?
Yes. Yeah, everyone wants peace all the time, everywhere, and they will go to enormous warfare lengths to get it.
Jonathan, just like Burke, the First World War, really. Yes.
Jonathan Burke, come again.
It is, of course, an obsession with history that has caused so much of the pain and bloodshed over the last 25 years in Northern Ireland. And those who seek the security of relying only on history rather than facing up to the present have done much to exacerbate that conflict. I'm not necessarily saying that was the tenor of the contribution you heard a minute ago, but it's not far off it. And it does lead me to question, really, how long people will go on putting up with those who simply won't sit down with each other and talk about the opportunity that is now there. The other day, Ian Paisley said, you can't expect any self-respecting unionist to sit down at the table with that kind of thing on the agenda. How anybody with any sense of self-respect could let an opportunity like this pass without even sitting down to talk about it beggars belief. And that, I suppose, is the difference between someone like myself, detached, if you like, from Northern Ireland, but still desperately involved in it as anybody in this country and in Northern Ireland is, and someone who relies exclusively on obsessive historical concerns without understanding that views in Northern Ireland have changed dramatically.
Mary Warnock.
I'm not sure how great this opportunity is. I mean, it isn't 25 years that there has been conflict. It's 70 years, ever since partition, or more than 70 years, ever since partition first occurred, the south of Ireland has had as its main aim to take over the government of the north of Ireland, the six counties, and to make a united Ireland. And this now seems to them to be the great opportunity. And I believe the opportunity for peace is really an opportunity for the south of Ireland to do what it has always wanted. I don't feel optimistic about it.
You don't feel optimistic about it, but given that analysis, would you contend that no one should bother to even try and make it work as a consequence? Is that of your pessimism?
Of course not. I mean, and I think the fact that there hasn't been any violence to speak of for 15 months is so far very good.
Okay, I'm going to leave it there and go on to our, thank you, to our next question.
Christine Seaborn. Sir Ian Vallance, chairman of BT, with a salary of nearly £700,000, considered it might be relaxing to be a junior doctor. Would the panel agree?
Jonathan Porritt.
No, and I don't imagine that Ian Vallance any longer would agree with himself. I think that they gave an account of what he did on the day when he made this particular gaffe, which has to go down as one of the biggest PR bloomers of all time. And I think that of the apparent 12 hours that he spends every day worrying about the fate of BT, he spent at least 8 of them on that particular day trying to clean up the mess after himself. You would have thought that someone who gets paid that amount of money would be rather more subtle in the way in which they handle the media.
Miles Kington.
No, I've known quite a lot of doctors in my life, and they're probably speechless with rage at this very moment, if they've got the time to be speechless with rage. But the thing that occurs to me is that one of his defenses that he made in his own behalf was that I work these long hours, as if this is somehow virtuous. These days, we're actually being told that people who work all the hours that God gives them are actually workaholics and non-productive. They tend to be going around in circles and making work for other people and taking on far too much. And I'd be more impressed, actually, if he worked fewer hours. Hannah, I'd be...
And you would up his salary accordingly, the more he reduced his hours. David Starkey.
Well, the idea of an inverse ratio between work and salary is one that, as an academic, appeals to me very profoundly. But it seems to me that we've got this a little bit wrong. Why are we so sympathetic with junior doctors? Ladies and gentlemen, may I let you into a big secret? Junior doctors become senior doctors. They become immensely overpaid and patronizing, and they award themselves merit awards of 50,000 a year at least. Put it the other way around too, there's a real substantial point. We are living in a world which has stood itself on its head. For most of the last 100 years, wages have been tending to converge. Wages and salaries are now tending to diverge. And the people who complain about this most loudly are newspaper editors who are paid between 150 and 200,000 a year. Jonathan, over to you.
Sorry. Mary Warnock?
I think it was an absurd remark and very ill-timed and tactless and whatnot. But I think the main point is whether we really do feel there's anything to be said for paying people, whoever they are, nearly £700,000. And this seems to me something which is both unnecessary and thoroughly tactless in the present state of the world, where, or this country, where there is a large number of people who actually haven't got enough money. And so whatever he said, and whatever the comparison with junior doctors, which was utter rubbish, and he should never have said it, I still think we ought to address the problem of enormously high salaries for people at the top of industries.
Miles Kington?
People always break down their hours into what they actually do for this money, but they never break down what they spend the money on. I'd like to know where the money goes.
Well, Ian Vallance, anyone else who's listening who wants to do any kind of breakdown at all, there's always any answers on this issue as on the others. It's after the Saturday edition of Any Questions. The number to ring is 071-580-4444. We'll get to our next question.
Simon De Quincey. Dartington has a reputation for supporting spiritual values. Would the panel agree such attitudes would improve the world and British politics?
Dartington, the trust, is in fact was inspired in part by the work of the Indian poet Tagore and is now the centre of the Schumacher Trust, named after the great environmentalist Fritz Schumacher. David Starkey.
In a word, no. I simply don't know. I simply don't know what spiritual values are. If you look at the ages that were labeled the ages of faith, like the Middle Ages, they were ages when the mass starved, when people were burned for being witches and other such imaginary crimes, when a hall like this was the center of a network of subordination and dependence, when women were their husbands' chattels. Lo, I believe the Bible said, by their fruits ye shall know them. That is the fruits of Christian spirituality, and I don't like it one little tiny bit. And particularly, I don't like the general repression of sexuality, which is also a product of those ages of faith, though not if I dare remind Dartington of some of the more awkward aspects of its past was not an aspect of Dartington.
David, does the existence, the concept of the human spirit therefore have no meaning for you, or is it just the values of that are described as spiritual values, or do you recognize some meaning in that term?
Human beings have consciousness. We are swayed by all kinds of things beyond reason. But to extract from that this thing called spirit and to oppose it to interest, to passion, to the desire to make money, to all for comfort, for all the other really sensible things that human beings are concerned about, I find preposterous.
Mary Warnock.
Well, I've always puzzled about the word spiritual, I have to say, and I don't quite know what it means. All the same, I do think that there is a distinction between the values of being comfortable and being rich and some other values, which are things that humans alone among all the animals are capable of aspiring to, ideals perhaps, or simply enjoying the idea of the world as a whole, or enjoying the idea of the countryside, or what on earth is the point of their being born and dying. All these questions only humans can raise. And I think that children at school, for example, are really impoverished if they are never introduced to all the kinds of poetry and words and thoughts and ideas which raise these questions. So I sympathize with the question, although I'm not absolutely clear how I would define the spiritual.
Mars Kington.
I think spiritual values, whatever they are, would be very dangerous if politicians were encouraged to hold them. I think they. I always shudder a bit when a politician starts to appeal to higher things. When he says, "I'm not doing this for the party. I'm doing this for the country, or for fairness, or for justice." When he's doing something for justice, it means somebody's about to be discriminated against. And when he's doing it for peace, it means somebody's going to get killed somewhere. And actually, there was a previous prime minister, Lord Melbourne, years and years ago, who was there when Queen Victoria came to the throne. And he said, I think religion is a very fine thing, but it shouldn't be allowed to intrude into private life.
And particularly his own, if you remember it.
I think that when you start giving politicians encouragement to adopt spiritual values, you're just giving them a bigger chance to adopt hypocrisy.
But on the other side of the question, do you believe that that attitudes that acknowledge the existence of spiritual values would improve, which is what the question also contained, would improve the world in some sense beyond that of party politics?
No.
Jonathan Porritt?
We get more crusades.
Jonathan Porritt.
Yes, it's certainly true that the conjunction of politics and religion or spirituality has not exactly been a happy one. Historically, I've just quoted Ian Paisley, after all. But having said that, and mindful of where we are, because after all, this place here, Dartington, is a pretty good example of the ways in which spiritual values can enrich and permeate people's lives very fruitfully indeed, and allow people to lead lives that are perhaps really are richer than might otherwise have been the case. I would assert categorically that the presence of a more spiritual set of values in our life today would probably make the prospects of a secure, sustainable future for us that much greater. And I think the loss of those spiritual values is a very severe loss indeed for many individuals and indeed communities and societies as a whole. The point about spiritual values, if I may say so, and the wording is important, is it doesn't mean fixed religious values. And the joy about Dartington and other places that uphold the value of spirituality is they do not exhort or mandate people to belong to one particular established faith or another. They recognize across different faiths that there are things that people are seeking for which they cannot find other than by recourse to or the value of different spiritual beliefs. And to dismiss that out of hand, given the millions of people who in a non-partisan, non-sectarian way derive meaning, purpose, joy, fulfillment by virtue of the spiritual faith, the spiritual beliefs they have, seems to me to be really dismissive to the point of lunacy. And in an age where, after all, nothing much seems to matter to anybody, but particularly politicians, unless it has a price tag attached to it, the more people who are able to see beyond that by reference to some spirituality, I think the better off we'd be.
David Starkey, you were
dismissive to the point of lunacy in Jonathan's
view. All people are obviously campaigning for self-abnegation and a revival of asceticism, and we're very good particularly at visiting this on others but not so much on ourselves. Jonathan's remarks have confirmed what I think. The Green Movement are the natural heirs of Christian monasticism. Let us all... Yes, exactly. Let us all do without. Let us all wear hemp. Let us all be homespun. Let us put away these wicked features of late capitalism. Let us, I suppose, get rid of modern medicine. Let us reduce life expectancy. No, it's true. I'm afraid you can't have the one without the other. And the fact you applaud as loudly as that just shows that you're trying to fill up the gap between your ears with the noise.
Dave... Before this program started, David Starkey said, "I hope you're going to introduce me as the rudest man in Britain." I said that he had lost that sobriquet. Perhaps he's trying to earn it back again with this audience at least. Jonathan Porritt, one word.
Well, actually, Jonathan, I don't think I'll bother to make any comment. I think, to be quite honest, anybody who can talk like that, and you've had two goes already, David, so keep going because you're doing a fantastic job. I really don't need to reply.
I'm going to come... Simon de Quincey, you asked the question.
I asked that question and used spiritual values because I knew it would bring out this argument. And I'm delighted Jonathan Porritt has broadened it out into a longer phrase, which includes humanistic principles, an appreciation of nature, and many, many other things, not just money, not just politics. And I would wish that the world and our politics took a look at it.
Thank you very much. Any answers, of course, for that, if you would like to continue that discussion. Next question, please.
Diane Dawson. Does the panel think that there are more important things to protest about than the export of live animals? And if so, what?
Miles Kington. You're looking terribly worried suddenly.
Well, this may be a rather frivolous thought. Yes, it's bound to be. But over the last week or so, I keep reading the papers about outbreaks of violence here and there. It's not just violence on the animal rights field. It's violence on the football field. It's violence here and violence there. And it sometimes occurs to me that maybe what we need is another war, that people are spoiling for lots of fights, and maybe just have a quick... peaceful war somewhere. The Americans keep doing it. When they get an excess of energy, they go invade Haiti or Grenada or somewhere. They say, "Hey, that was a good war. We won that." And they go back home again. I actually once heard a talk in the BBC archives by Aldous Huxley called "Why Do Wars Happen?" And he found out the strange statistic that during wartime, suicide figures fell dramatically, not just in the nations that were at war, but in the nations that were neighboring the nations at war. As if something exciting was happening at last. It's just a horrible reflection on human nature, but I just wonder if there was some way of having, a war to lance all this violence. I mean, the Falklands Islands are now sort of almost derelict, and I think it'd be nice if it was kept as a sort of neutral ground to have a war occasionally. We go and, every 10 years, just go and get rid of all the aggression and...
Mary Warnock.
Well, it was a frivolous idea.
Mary Warnock.
Well, yes, I do think there are more important things to protest about. I'm not against protesting about the treatment of animals, because I think we ought not, being human, to be cruel to other living creatures. And I think that if we are being cruel to them, then we should, it's perfectly respectable for people to protest about this bad behavior. But I do really believe that humans are more to be protected than animals, other animals, and that therefore wherever we find bad treatment of other humans, it is more important to protest about that. And I personally would protest far more violently against the incarceration, say, of young children in the new children's prisons, than I would protest against the incarceration of calves in small spaces where they are incarcerated. So I genuinely believe that wherever we see cruelty to humans, that is more important to protest about than cruelty to animals.
Mm-hmm. Mary, do you have the feeling, which is sometimes said of the British, which appears to be implicit in what you're saying, that the British care more about animals than they do about people, which in fact underlies the question?
Well, I think that it's perfectly true that we are very, very bad at loving our children, compared with, say, the Italians or many other countries. I think we're extremely disagreeable to our own children as a nation, and that I would, if I'd got to campaign about something and tie myself to the railings, I'd campaign for a different attitude to our own children rather than to small calves.
Jonathan Porritt.
Well, I think the answer to the question is yes. There are many, many more important things to campaign about, to protest about, than the export of live animals. Mary's mentioned one of them. One could go on. It's a very long list. And many of the things would be extremely weighty and hang very heavily on us. Poverty in the third world, global destruction, the astonishing amount of airspace given to intolerant, bigoted historians. And one could go on. One could go on for really a very long time. But I don't actually think that is quite what this question should come down to. Because although in its narrowest focus, the campaign going on at the moment is about saving those creatures from export and therefore from a crueler death than they would have in this country, behind it, there is a totally different philosophical stance than that which I think you're picking up on there, Mary. It isn't that they put animals higher than human beings, although on occasions, understandably, the media will home in on somebody who can be guaranteed to say, yes, I care more about animals than I do about humans. But the vast mass of people who are out there campaigning wouldn't say that. They would actually say that part of their care for human beings is to ensure that we care more about animals, because by doing violence to animals, we do violence to ourselves. Now, if that is the case, and I think many of them would argue that very, very strongly, then you can actually say that this isn't so much a campaign against a specific malfunction of modern farming. It is a campaign for a different interpretation of humanity. And if you read it that large, then simply making a comparison between campaigning against the export of live animals or campaigning for abused children, I don't think does philosophical justice to what is going on at the moment.
Dr. Starkey.
I'd like to turn the question round, if I may, and say that I think there are far too many things too important to protest about, if by protest we mean the kind of thing that's been going on now. What do we mean by it? We mean somebody effectively committing suicide. We mean, in response to that, stoning a house where a single woman is so that every window is smashed. We mean the mother of the woman who killed saying she doesn't regret the deaths when the aircraft crashed. We mean, it seems to me, an attitude, contrary to what Jonathan said, which abnegates reason. We have also an attitude, which Jonathan denied, which confuses the essential differences between being human and being animal. Because the great gift of a human being, though you wouldn't know it from Jonathan's last remark, is to reason, is to debate. And what seems to me to have gone so badly wrong is that when people feel strongly, I do not deny that people maybe feel strongly, perhaps should feel strongly about animal export, what they do is to throw stones, is to lie down in front of lorries, is to stop people going about what is, after all, their ordinary, lawful business. And when nice middle-class people put themselves on the sides of those like Timpson, that's the girlfriend of Miss Phipps, who says destroying property is okay, why don't they think what they're doing? Why don't they think the path down which they're going? Why don't they realize that this is the politics of the Third Reich and that Hitler was also, of course, a vegetarian?
Jonathan Porritt.
I just feel that outrage about the violence that has occurred is copping out too easily of the issues. I, oddly enough, David, you may be surprised to know, share with you the abhorrence that you've just expressed for the violence that some people have shown in these demonstrations. I find it utterly repugnant that people who are seeking to defend the lives of other creatures condone violence against human beings. I find it inexplicable and morally unacceptable. And
you said that first.
Hang on, let him say it the way he wants
well,
to say
oddly
it.
Enough, it wasn't the question, but sometimes one tries to stick to the question. But having said that, and feeling that very, very strongly, and I've said that throughout my life as a green activist, that I, in no circumstances do I believe that kind of violence can possibly be tolerated. You've got to sort those episodes out, which are regrettable and actually stupid, of course, because they give a lot of other people a reason to condemn the vast mass of responsible, peaceful, non-violent demonstrations that are going on. So they're dead stupid. And anybody who thinks they're gaining for their cause by taking those kind of actions like stoning people's houses and so on, you're just completely wrong. But having said that, you've got to look beyond that, and you've got to look at the mainstream campaigner in a way that I think your comments, David, totally overlooked.
Miles Pinkton.
I'd just like to say that if the British were really fond of animals, then we wouldn't have battery chicken farming, we wouldn't have factory farming, we wouldn't have lots of other things like that. And when David Starkey brought up the Third Reich, whenever I pass in the distance a sort of long, low, grim-looking shed, where I know thousands of chickens are having a horrible life, I actually think of Auschwitz. And the comparison is not so very different. And it may be in years to come we'll look back and say, how could we let it go on?
No, Miles.
Oh, sorry.
No. don't think of Auschwitz. Really. Look, it is a terribly difficult area, but it does not help. I don't believe it helps to make comparisons of that kind. You cannot possibly compare what happened at Auschwitz to the things that we do in this country today to animals. It does demean our humanity to talk in those terms. It does allow people like David to portray anybody who cares about animals as if we're all complete nutters and uncaring about humanity. You can't make those comparisons, but you can campaign forcefully and actively to stop the unnecessary cruelty that we use against animals.
Baroness Warnock.
I absolutely agree with Jonathan. I think we've got to recognize that humans do use animals, not just to eat them, but to ride them and to milk them. We use them, and most of us regard that as perfectly legitimate. What we can increasingly learn, I think, is to treat them without cruelty. And I think, in a way, I understand what Jonathan is saying when he says that these kinds of protests are protests in favor of a kind of humanity. We've got to learn to be less cruel. But actually, to suppose that we'll ever look back on the day when we transported animals or ate animals or whatnot as an age of barbarism seems to me absolutely wrong. We are in a position that is unique in the animal kingdom, and we always shall be.
Miles Kington, one more word.
We're in the position to blow the world up, and they aren't.
Yes, and always shall be.
No, the only comparison I want to make with Auschwitz, I wasn't saying what happened in Auschwitz was like what's happening there. I'm just saying the way we treat it is, the way we don't talk about it, and the way we say, oh, well, you know, it's happening, so don't talk about it.
We have, and doubtless we will again, but we'll go to our next question.
Trevor Meppen, what, in your view, are the guiding principles of education that have a lasting relevance for yesterday, today, and tomorrow?
The guiding principles of education, a lasting relevance yesterday, today, and tomorrow. David Starkey.
I think there are really two. The first is all education, by definition, is an inculcation into, I'm going to challenge Jonathan here, and I'm sure he'll come back at me, the past, if you like, into a series of academic traditions in literature, in languages, in science. These we call the academic disciplines. You learn them in order to change them. You master them in order to transform them, but you have to master them. And if you don't do that, you will get nowhere. Point one. Point two is about mastering a series of techniques, basically in number and in language. And if you don't do that, not only can't you function academically, you can't function practically either. And finally, and most importantly of all, it's about a kind of reasoned teaching of radicalism, about questioning the meaning of words, of ideas, and of language. All the time, remember that wonderful phrase, if you can see further, it's because you stand on the shoulder of giants. The final process, the final thing at which you know you've achieved that eternal verity in education is when you can kick the giant away and stand or float alone.
Miles Pinkton.
Well, I read a piece in The New Yorker once talking about British comedy, and it said that what makes British comedy different from any other kind of comedy is the British educational system, which depends more on the accretion of useless knowledge than any other country in the world. And that is why, he went on to say, you get Monty Python programs having sketches called Summarize Proust in 7 seconds. He said nowhere else in the world would anyone know who Proust was, so they couldn't have it. And this at a lower level works because all those things that we desperately avoided learning at school crop up later in life when we go in for pub quizzes. Why? Only the British, I think, have pub quizzes. All these people who left school saying, I'll never take another exam, go flocking off to pubs to take another exam. And then they wish they'd paid attention when the list of Henry VIII's wives came out. So if there are any school children listening in, for God's sake, pay attention, because you're going to be a pub quiz one day.
Jonathan Porritt.
Well, I defer to the two panellists who've gone so far, Jonathan, and particularly to David, with whom I agree much more than he might imagine. I'd add one ingredient, of course, to his extremely erudite list, which is a guiding principle of education should be fun. Because all the wondrous and extremely earnest things which he mentioned, to which I do genuinely subscribe, probably won't make it over the threshold unless children are given a real sense of adventure, discovery, and fun. But apart from that minor addition to the thesis, as it were, I think we are as one, David.
This will deeply disappoint Dr. Starkey. Baroness Warnock.
Well, I think one of the things that will forever go on as one of the points of education is that children should be enabled to enjoy an enormous number of things that they wouldn't have enjoyed if they hadn't been taught. And I think the foundation of education on increased pleasure is something which has rather a bad name, but actually is terribly important. And if you open their eyes and increase their imaginative powers and so on, you do increase the amount of enjoyment which goes along with understanding that they have of the place where they live, the world that they live in. And I quite agree that you can't understand where you are now or how you can prove the future unless you understand how you got there, which is understanding history. And you can't manage your own world unless you understand how to use a language, how to calculate, and so on. But I do think that the values of society, that is, the things that we think are nice and nasty, the things that we think are intolerable and tolerable, are a very important part of education. And that means that no education is working unless it's enjoyable for the pupils who undertake it. So that would be my contribution to this thought of what is eternally the same and worthwhile in education, enjoyment.
Thank you very much. Our next question.
Chris Barber. As a teacher of English to foreign students, I'm often asked, what is the essence, the spirit of Britain? How would the team answer?
Miles Kington, you look like someone who wanted to start on that.
So was that the essence of Britain?
The essence,
England,
the spirit
Britain?
Of Britain. We use the word spirit in a sense which I hope David Starkey will be able to come to answer it himself. Anyway,
I think the essence of Britain is being British when you want to and English when you want to. That we have not yet even agreed on what being British is. Billy Bragg's been doing a series on the radio recently, asking people if they're British or Welsh or Scottish or Irish. And the answers are illuminating because the Scots always took it as a chance to get a dig at the English. But I mean, there's no other country in the world besides Britain that would have four football teams. Is it four? Yes, we've got four football teams. How the Europeans let us get away with it year after year, putting in Wales, Northern Ireland, Scotland and England, four chances for one? I don't know.
Well, isn't it because they're less likely to win that way? If you put the best of them all together in the same team, if they weren't at war with each other, they might win one of these championships one day.
Well, that doesn't work for cricket.
You mean you've been watching the British football team? The British cricket team?
No. Actually, no, the funny thing is that you never hear anyone shouting, come on, Britain. Occasionally we get a British team. We get the British Lions or we get the British athletic team. But do you shout, come on, Britain? It sounds odd, doesn't it? Come on, Britain.
Does anyone in this hall ever shout, come on, Britain? One hand up, no hands up, not a single person ever does it. You're quite right, Miles. David Starkey.
Well, we all know Britons went around in woad and not much else, particularly in this part of the world. And I think the thing we need to remember is that Britain simply is dead. I would even argue still further that England itself is dead. This is why we're seeing the rising regionalism. The West Country is a prime example of this. And if I were you, and I were talking to my students, I'd say, well, think of English like that other great world language. Think of it like Latin. It was produced by this little tiny city-state, Rome, which grew and grew and conquered a world empire and gave its language and its law and its literature. And then with the effort, it died. And I'd say to those students, you're very lucky. You're living at the moment of the death of England. Enjoy it.
Mary Warnock.
Well, I agree with some of that, but I do think that the central thing about the spirit of Britain, so-called, is the English language, as a matter of fact. And along with the English language goes English law, English liturgy, English... But coming back to it, language. And I don't think that's ever going to die. Your students... may be lucky that they still have you to teach them, but the fact is they'll go on speaking English and having this tremendous tradition of a wonderful, flexible language that can be used in a million different ways, still as the very heart of their experience after their teachers are dead and when they're teaching somebody else. So the spirit of Britain, in my view, is the English language.
Jonathan Porritt.
Yes, indeed. As a teacher of English for 10 years, I'd find it very difficult to disagree with that, but therefore I will disagree with it. And I think that although language does count for a very great deal, I would add one thing to it, which is the relationship between people and place in Britain, the relationship between community and land, the sense of being what we are as a consequence of how we live on and manage the land, some of which is still very fresh and alive, some of which is a sort of weird amalgam of nostalgic visions of what the countryside might once have been. But even for people who live in cities, in fact, particularly for people who live in cities, the notion that we are still wedded to and part of the land is still very powerfully alive. And I do think that we are shaped. I wouldn't say we're shaped more in this country by our relationship with the land, but we are powerfully shaped by it, and I wish that we could make more sense of it today.
One word, David, because I want to go to our questioner.
I think Jonathan has illustrated the fact that he's utterly nostalgic. This vision of England as lots of little villages, manor houses and rectories is stone dead, and only Jonathan has failed to recognise it.
Dear, oh dear, I thought the harmony was going to last, and mercifully it didn't. Can we go back to our questioner, Chris Barber, on this? A phrase or two of what you say when you answer that question to your foreign language students.
I have trouble, of course, because I have, unfortunately, great understanding of what David Starkey says here. I think... the sad demise of a once great nation, if you look politically, socially, and indeed morally and financially, the demise of a great nation.
God, you're also gloomy.
What a note on which to end, but maybe you'll be able to help us out if you take a different view in any answers. That's all we have time for from this program in Dartington Hall. Next week, we're going to be in Handsworth in Birmingham, where the panel will be Mingus Campbell, who's the Foreign Affairs Spokesman for the Liberal Democrats, Brian Marwini, the Transport Secretary, Alison Norman, a Health Administrator, and Joyce Quinn, who speaks on Foreign Affairs for the Labour Party. Join us then, but from here in this magnificent, wonderful medieval hall, where we've had modern and medieval language. Goodbye.
And on the team this week were Miles Kingston, Jonathan Porritt, Dr. David Starkey and Baroness Warnock. Jonathan Dimbleby was the chairman, the producer Nick Utekin.